Welcome back. This is Vancouver Co-op Radio. We want to start this CFRO 102.7 FM, www.cooperadio.org, live on the internet. And this is the Monday Brambagger. I'm Alfred Weber, and we have a very special guest today, independent scientist Loren Murray, who was an expert witness at the Tokyo Tribunal for War Crimes in Afghanistan. And we'll be speaking about Washington, D.C.'s secret nuclear war against Iran with the objective of keeping China out of Central Asia and looking at all of the issues surrounding Central and South Asian oil and gas, and including in there issues coming up around BP Petroleum, because all of this is connected as well to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Welcome, Loren.
Thank you, Alfred. It's always nice to be on your program, and I love your audience.
Thank you. Well, you've prepared a history of the secret nuclear war by the United States against Iran, starting in 1986 and going up to present, and in fact going to the history of British Petroleum, BP, and maybe that's a good place to start.
Well, British Petroleum started in Iran. It's actually owned by Queen Elizabeth. And it was in the 30s, I think, after the overthrow of the last Qajar Shah and the Pahlavi, the Shah's father, who was an army colonel, and he staged a coup and ended up being the leader of Iran. He started the Pahlavi dynasty. And that was about the British wanting to get into Iran to get the oil and gas reserves or the natural resources.
Right. And so with the throne of England owning BP, is this part of the City of London strategy, or?
Well, yes, and of course the Queen of the Netherlands owns over 50% of Shell Oil.
Right.
So the monarchies have some kind of a split with the bankers. And the
right.
bankers run the operations. And as you pointed out, British Petroleum is a bank. It's not an oil company. So maybe you would like to explain that for the listeners.
Well, it's just that BP, as it's now called, should really be thought of more as a banking institution specializing in petroleum exploration more than a oil company as such. And that's why, for example, in specific cases, BP has penalties and fines up in the area of 760-something, whereas the other oil companies will have two or three a year because it's a company that's led by bankers and the majority shareholder, I think, is J.P. Morgan Chase, and the beneficial owner might go back to the to the throne of England, and so in that case, we're really dealing with a banking a banking institution that has no regard whatsoever for the externalized costs of the environment. And so how does this relate to the Chernobyl incident?
Well, you have that graph. We should put it up on the internet.
Okay.
For the public to
People can see this by going to peaceinspace.org. Go to peaceinspace.org and you will see the graph.
And what I did was I'm a geoscientist, so I just couldn't understand why they were using depleted uranium since 1993 in the Yom Kippur War, when it's a radiological weapon. It's extremely, extremely pernicious poison. It goes all over the world. It's causing infertility globally. I mean, it's wrecking the biological, the biosphere. So what I did was I got out I looked on the internet and I found a chart with historic oil prices on it from 1946 to 2009. And I just wanted to look at that and think about it. And what I observed was that from 1946 until 1973, when Kissinger engineered the Yom Kippur War, or the oil crisis in the Middle East, oil prices were flat, and they were about $20 a barrel. That's an inflation-adjusted oil price. At the nominal oil price in those years, was about $3 to $5 a barrel. Now, the first oil price hike started, and that is from 1946 to 73. That's a long time for oil prices to not waver a cent, practically. But right after the 1973 oil crisis and the Yom Kippur War, when Kissinger or the U.S. government gave depleted uranium weapons to the Israelis to use against the Arabs in the Yom Kippur War, and they wiped them out. The Egyptian tanks and everything were just completely destroyed, but the Golan Heights was also completely contaminated with depleted uranium. And the oil prices doubled immediately. They went up to $40 a barrel. And that's the inflation-adjusted oil price. Then they engineered the Iran-Iraq War, which I think it ended in 1980. And that drove oil prices up. Maybe it was longer than that. But the peak oil price was over $100 a barrel, $105 a barrel in 1979. And, of course, the U.S. and the London bankers funded and sold weapons and gave weapons to Iran and to Iraq. And they didn't care which side won. They just wanted to create a self-cleaning oven out of the Iran-Iraq region where they annihilated each other. And that's basically what they do in ghettos in the U.S. By exploiting differences in ethnicity and religion in ghettos, and then they create a war zone, and the residents in the ghettos are just annihilated. So that really worked. Iraq and Iran lost millions of young men. And so oil prices started declining, and by 1986, oil prices were back down to about $23 a barrel. So, and that would be the inflation-adjusted oil price. So every time the dollar goes down, what I noticed is that, and this is continuously through 2009, now we can say 2010, and what I noticed is that there was immediately a nuclear false flag event or a depleted uranium and nuclear war. And that includes Chernobyl in 1986, Gulf War I in 1991, the Yugoslavian War in 1995, the NATO attack on Yugoslavia in 1998, 9/11, New York City is radioactive from 9/11, it still is, and the 2003 Iraq War, the Israeli attack on Lebanon in 2006, and then, of course, the attacks on Gaza starting in 2009. So it's just been a continuum of oil equals nuclear war plus dollar, the dollar. And so every time the dollar declines, there's another war engineered. Now, tell me where the dollar is today.
You mean
the U.S. economy and the value of the dollar is in the tank now. So it's really time for another nuclear war.
Well, when you say nuclear war, could you define that for our audience? Because the convention is that nuclear wars don't happen. And I know that you have been reporting on secret nuclear wars.
Yes.
So why don't we go into what the secret nuclear wars are?
Well, depleted uranium was proposed for development in World War II under the Manhattan Project by James Conant and Urey and Compton. And they were the S1 Poison Gas Committee under the Manhattan Project. And in 1943, they wrote a memo to General Leslie Groves and proposed that depleted uranium and fission products, which they didn't have any of, could be used. Well, they weren't sure the atomic bombs would work. So they said, well, we can take all the radioactive trash and we can make dirty bombs, dirty missiles, and dirty bullets out of it. And since uranium is a pyrophoric metal, in other words, it catches on fire at 170 degrees centigrade, or it ignites, and it very rapidly reaches extremely high temperatures, as high as 5,000 degrees centigrade, which is the temperature hotter than the sun, it just vaporizes the metal into a radioactive poison gas. And they said it would be a permanent terrain contaminant, and not only enemies would be contaminated if they entered contaminated terrain, but our own soldiers would be too. We wouldn't escape the nuclear war either. And they said it would contaminate the atmosphere, the air we breathe, and internally contaminate people in those regions, and including our own soldiers. And it would contaminate the soil and the food, the drinking water, and irrigation water. And it would go right through the skin and right into the lungs, into the bloodstream, and contaminate the blood. So it was an illegal weapon at that time because it violates the 1925 Geneva Poison Gas Protocol, but it's also illegal under the Geneva and Hague Conventions, all war conventions. It meets the definition of weapon of mass destruction in 2 out of 3 categories under U.S. federal code. And it also violates U.S. military law. They're violating their own laws because we are signatories to the Geneva and Hague Conventions. So I don't know if you might like to make a comment on the legality or illegality of depleted uranium, but it is a nuclear weapon because the energy is released from the nucleus. It just happens slowly because it's through natural decay of uranium into even more radioactive decay products. And so I like to call it the Trojan horse of nuclear war. It's the weapon that keeps giving. It's the weapon that keeps killing because it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. There's no way to turn it off, and there's no way to clean it up. And, Alfred, they have released the equivalent number of radioactive atoms of hundreds and thousands and millions of, many millions of Nagasaki bombs.
This is in the area of Central Asia, you're saying?
In Iraq, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, Somalia, the Sudan, Grenada, Panama, Mindanao, in the Philippines, Okinawa, Korea, all over Australia, Vieques Island in Puerto Rico, all U.S. military bases, not only in the U.S., but around the world. We've contaminated Germany, Belgium. It's all over the world. It's in our backyards. It's their backyards. It has been detected in the ice record in Antarctica, on Greenland, the Greenland ice sheet, in the Alps, in the Himalayas, on Mauna Loa in Hawaii, and the Andes and tropical glaciers all over the world.
So this, in a sense, is a secret nuclear war by the United States against the world.
It's a secret nuclear war, but...
I'm sorry we're having these technical problems, but this seems to be a secret nuclear war by the United States against the world, including against the people of the United States and the people of the entire world.
That's correct. It's a global depopulation agenda. It was the top priority that Kissinger mentioned in National Security Memo 200, 1974, and he said that population control is the highest priority of U.S. national security. We need to depopulate regions in third world countries where we need to secure natural resources to maintain our hegemony.
So this could go in many different directions. We could talk about the secret nuclear war against humanity, or we could narrow it back in against Iran. Since the United States and Israel seem to be threatening a nuclear war against Iran and seems to be trying to rack up a scenario in that direction, why don't we start looking there and seeing exactly what they're seeking? So you're saying that Iran has been targeted since 1986, at least, which was Chernobyl forward, because that radiation, and then with the DU wars in Iraq, and in 2001 the DU wars in Afghanistan, which meant 9/11, that was all directed toward Iran as well as other parts of Central Asia.
It most certainly was, and I was very surprised to learn this, but Peter Eyre began working with me. He's a British former naval military intelligence officer. And he, after he got out of the British Navy, he worked at NATO headquarters before he left the Navy. He was a cryptologist, so he worked with the top spies around the world. And so he's a very, very experienced person. He's a meteorologist, and he ran airline companies when he got out, and he was also a Middle East oil and gas consultant. So his knowledge base is very broad, and he has a very, very vast knowledge of the military and military protocol and weapon systems, but also the meteorology. And on top of that, he's extremely opposed to the use of depleted uranium and nuclear weapons. So what he did was he started making airflow charts for me, and we began following a storm fronts or cyclone circulation systems that are part of the early monsoon in Southeast Asia. And we were able to develop a very, very sophisticated understanding of how the weather predisposes or contaminates certain regions, and other regions escape from contamination from particular conflicts. And it all depends on the monsoon, the winter and summer monsoon cycles in Asia and the Eurasian continent. And in North and South America, it's different. It's the hurricane season and other circulation patterns. But it's all controlled by rainfall and snow, as well as fog and other atmospheric moisture, because the tiny radioactive particles, dust particles that are invisible in the atmosphere are nucleating agents for moisture, and when enough moisture condenses on them, they fall out of the sky like as rain or snow. So that's how the radiation gets into the environment. Now, what we discovered is something called the Silk Road esophageal cancer epidemic. There's an epidemic along the Silk Route, the ancient Silk Route, which from Iran all the way through sort of northern China, past Mongolia, and then it goes out into the Pacific over Taiwan and Japan and the Korea area. And there are very, very high rates of cancer of the esophagus, which would be a pathway cancer. In other words, the air with contamination in it is going down the esophagus and exposing that part of the body to very, very dangerous radioactive particles. And it's causing esophageal cancer in certain parts of Iran and across the Silk Road. So we started really investigating what was going on, and he did airflow charts for me in the summer and the winter and different months, the airflow charts for Iran. And Alfred, science is so wonderful because it's real. It's, you can't fool it. You can't manipulate it. It's what's happening. And what I discovered is that in certain times of the monsoon seasons, the winds blow and the rain and snow come from Iraq, the Iraq direction, and the mountainous border of Iran with Iraq is a north-south mountain chain called the Zagros Mountains. And the east-west mountain chain from Iraq, or the Iraq border to the border of Afghanistan, nearly the border of Afghanistan, are the Elburz Mountains, which are at the south end of the Caspian Sea. And guess where the highest cancer rates and infertility rates in Iran were? They were on the north slope and the south slope of the Elburz Mountains, where there's very high rainfall and snow out of the radiation, and also on the north and south slope of the the east and west slopes of the Zagros Mountains, which go north and south on the west side of Iran. And so I began looking at the extreme drop in fertility in Iran. I mean, it makes me sick to even talk about it. But in 1986, before Chernobyl, the fertility rate in Iran was more than 8 children per woman. They like to have large families in the Middle East. Many of the areas have tribal structures or tribal cultures, and they like to have a lot of children. And by 2002, the fertility rate in Iran had dropped to less than 1.6 children per woman for the whole country in 14 years. That is a catastrophic drop, and the only thing that could cause something like that across the whole entire country was an environmental catastrophe. And that catastrophe is the secret nuclear wars the U.S. and coalition forces have carried out in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yugoslavia.
And the purpose is to depopulate that area for a resource grab, is that it?
Absolutely. I'm going to read what Kissinger said. I mean, he just said it really clearly. He said, Dr. Henry Kissinger, this is the April 24th, 1974 National Security Memo 200. Dr. Henry Kissinger proposed in his memorandum to the NSC that, quote, depopulation should be the highest priority of U.S. foreign policy towards the Third World, unquote. He quoted reasons of national security and because the U.S. economy will require large and increasing amounts of minerals from abroad, especially from less developed countries. Wherever a lessening of population can increase the prospects for such stability, population policy becomes relevant to resources, supplies, and to the economic interests of the U.S., unquote. And that is exactly what the agenda is today with Israel and the U.S. sitting offshore with nuclear missiles and nuclear bombs on their ships offshore of Iran. And what they are worried about is the Afghanistan-Pakistan corridor, which we more or less have control of now, but they are fearful that China will come to dominate or influence Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that would squeeze out the U.S. and coalition forces completely from Central Asia, and that would be from Azerbaijan on the west side of the Caspian Sea, including Iran, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Myanmar, which is the former Burma. So the U.S. is, and NATO forces intend to balkanize Afghanistan and Pakistan and to steal Sistan and Balochistan, which is the southeastern corner of Iran. It's a tribal area that the people in history are related to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And if we balkanize it, Pakistan and Afghanistan, it will make it much, much, much more difficult for China and Iran to cooperate and collaborate and support each other and to use, to market, and to move oil resources from Central Asian countries to the European countries and other maybe Asian countries or African countries who need energy supplies.
So that's part of the hidden purpose of the Afghanistan war then?
That is, as well as Balochistan has extremely rich mineral and energy resources. So they want to go in and loot Sistan and Balochistan, as they have planned to do with major mining projects all over the world, Haiti, Norway, the whole northern belt from Turkey all the way to Istanbul, the whole northern part of Turkey, Tajikistan, and the Sumatra Southeast Asian Island Arc region. And all of these areas are extremely rich mineral belts that were part of plate tectonics or continents and tectonic plates colliding. And where this happens, the seafloor and continent will collide, for instance. Or India collided with Asia and pushed up the Himalayas. And so you have ancient seafloor that's just full of metals and minerals and oil and gas all through the Himalayas. And it's really HAARP and the ability to remotely do subsurface exploration for minerals and energy resources from satellites and from HAARP. And they can do it with radio tomography, sitting in an office anywhere in the world. They just hook up to the satellite or HAARP. They transmit a 30-watt radio signal into the ground from the satellite or HAARP. And whatever substances it interacts with change the frequency of that signal so that when it returns to the satellite or to HAARP, they can tell exactly what metals or minerals are there. And they can also tell the grade of the ore, so they can actually do very detailed mapping of ore bodies from space. And my God, if you had to do that on the ground, which is the old-fashioned way of doing it, it would be very difficult or impossible in the regions that they are, that they've already mapped.
Now, we're sort of getting ahead ourselves, because I want to go back and begin to unfold the nuclear issues around Iran. But first, I'd like to just ask, why would the United States and Israel gamble everything on an attack on Iran when that could so rapidly escalate into a global nuclear war?
Well, it started with the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the five superpower nuclear states, that would be the U.S., Britain, Russia, China, and what's the other one?
U.K.?
Let's see. There are four. I think there are four or five. Anyway, the superpowers wanted this non-proliferation treaty, and other countries who were non-nuclear states wanted it, and citizens all over the world wanted it because of the threat of nuclear annihilation. And the non-proliferation treaty basically requires the nuclear states to dismantle their nuclear arsenals, and it requires non-nuclear states to refrain from developing nuclear weapons or having a nuclear weapons program, and from using them if they do have it. So it's to deter non-nuclear countries from having nuclear capability, and it requires nuclear states to not proliferate weapons, but also to dismantle their own arsenals. And it was a bankrupt treaty and a trick from the very beginning. But in 1995, President Clinton, at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference, they have them every few years, he was desperate, and the nuclear states were desperate to get 170 non-nuclear countries to permanently or indefinitely extend the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which had to be renewed in 1995. So Clinton stood up and gave a negative security assurance to 170 non-nuclear countries. And This basically is, quote, the United States reaffirms that it will not use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon, or which means NPT parties, except in the case of an invasion or any other attack on the United States, its territories, its armed forces or other troops, its allies, or on a state toward which it has a security commitment, carried out or sustained by such a non-nuclear weapon state in association or alliance with a nuclear weapon state. Now, the problem is that Israel illegally and secretly developed a nuclear weapons program, but Britain and the United States secretly gave them the essential components and helped them develop a nuclear weapons program, because Britain and the U.S. wanted Israel to be a destabilizing agent in the Middle East, which it certainly has been. And so Israel is not even a party to the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but they also refuse to be inspected by the IAEA or any other international body. They are receiving illegally by interbase, by through base transfers that don't even alert Congress or the President, weapons of mass destruction from the U.S., because now some Israeli bases are joint U.S. bases, and when they do base transfers, they're not required to notify Congress or the President, get a sign-off by the President. And India and China, India and Pakistan also are not parties to the NPT. So we have three outliers, Israel, India, and Pakistan, who have nuclear weapons programs, but they haven't signed any treaties. So they're sort of rogue states in that sense. The United States has violated the NPT from the beginning by proliferating nuclear weapons. We gave Israel and we funded the Pakistan nuclear weapons program. It's called the Pan-Arab Nuclear Weapons Program. George Herbert Walker Bush did that through the CIA. And we've also used depleted uranium in countries all over the world, contaminated the whole biosphere of the entire planet. It's an illegal weapon. It's been all of the DU weapons that we've used since 1990 have been made with Canadian uranium, which violates the Canadian Constitution. And so it's just the nuclear establishment is just a completely unaccountable, rogue, illegal, permanent war crimes racketeering syndicate. And the problem with the depleted uranium is that the U.S. categorized it as a conventional weapon, in other words, to make it more politically acceptable to other countries, and what it's done is it's blurred the difference between nuclear and conventional weapons in order to reintroduce real nuclear weapons, the thermonuclear weapons, to the military arsenal, U.S. military arsenal. And so what we've done now is we've been developing illegally and secretly small-yield tactical nuclear weapons that can be from 0.3 of a kiloton to 300 or 400 kilotons. And they've even developed, like, the B-61 series. These are nuclear warheads, they're missiles really, that have a dial-a-nuke feature. In other words, before you load it on the plane, you dial the kiloton yield that you want for that particular target, and it's variable. So you have a nuclear weapon that you can use at any kilotonnage between 0.3 of a kiloton to 3 or 4 kilotons. So that's illegal. Now, why are Israel and the U.S. sitting off of Iran with nuclear missiles and nuclear weapons, threatening Iran? Iran isn't afraid because they have the Russian Topol or Sunburn nuclear missile. It's called SSN-22. And the NATO code name is SSN-22 Sunburn. It's a 9,000-pound missile that flies at Mach 3, three times the speed of sound, 9 feet off the ground. It's armed with a 200-kiloton nuclear warhead, which is 10 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. And it's got a 750-pound conventional warhead. You have an option. And that's certainly depleted uranium. And it's got a range of 100 miles. So it also has booster rockets in the back of it, so it can carry out violent end maneuvers that elude enemy defenses. It is the most lethal missile in the world today, and there's absolutely no way to protect yourself against it. And that missile made the entire surface Navy globally obsolete.
Right. So we're beginning to unfold some of the background as to why the U.S. and Israel fleet is sitting off of Iran. And you know, I've read some reports which I've discounted, but nevertheless they're there, that there will be an attempt to attack Iran.
Well, certainly nuclear weapons are an option, because in 2001, the Bush administration had already opened the door to first strike plans and covert testing of new designs with their nuclear posture review, which had a first strike option. And let's see, quote, the Bush administration's first U.S. nuclear posture review had already called for fast-track development of new tactical nuclear weapons, a resumption of nuclear tests, which they did, and more flexible, adaptable strike plans, including options for variable and reduced yields, which they have now. This is reversing. They also reversed on December 31st, 2001, the neocons follow-up con plan, CONPLAN 802218, which reversed the U.S. policy against first use of nuclear weapons. Instead of a defensive use, a response to an attack, the U.S. gave themselves permission to attack first with no reason with nuclear weapons. And they just said, we can rapidly deploy nuclear weapons to destroy time-urgent targets anywhere in the world.
Right, right.
Now, the danger of developing low-yield nuclear weapons by nuclear superpowers to use against non-nuclear third world states, and it said in the many objections by many scientists in the U.S. who opposed developing low-yield nuclear weapons, they said the purpose for developing these is to use against third world countries. Well, those are weaker countries with mineral resources we want to steal. And so now, Alfred, we have nuclear weapons we can use on anyone, including those member states who signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty with the U.S. and the other superpowers, and it's a completely bankrupt treaty. Now, the inherent danger in the development of low-yield nuclear weapons by nuclear superpowers is that non-nuclear third-world countries in regions where tremendous mineral wealth is still underdeveloped as undeveloped, as Kissinger pointed out, they are unable to defend themselves from hostile and predatory Western exploitation for geopolitical interests by using low-yield nuclear weapons. And that's exactly what we've seen happen in Iraq, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and it's just going to continue country after country.
Right. Now, let's get back to the issue of Iran. What seems to be Israel and the United States' beef there, I don't see. The IAEA has found no violation with Iran's activities. With the Iran-Turkey-Brazil partnership, what they've done is they've shown a, with a transparent partnership, they've taken the whole issue of uranium enrichment and taking it out of play.
Well, let's go back to Kissinger and Ford. Henry Kissinger gave nuclear power plants to Iran. This is when the Shah was in power. And when Ford was president, he gave plutonium to Iran. Plutonium is only for nuclear weapons. So the U.S. has actually proliferated nuclear weapons and nuclear materials illegally in Iran in the past. The Non-Proliferation Treaty actually encourages member states to develop nuclear power. They're encouraged to. And under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, if they decide to build nuclear power plants, they are legally allowed under the treaty to enrich uranium for nuclear fuel for their power plants. The IAEA inspects the member states who signed the NPT, and they have done surprise visits. They've responded to complaints and false accusations by the U.S. and Israel that Iran was developing nuclear weapons. They have never found that Iran was in violation. What Iran has done, though, is to take control away from the U.S., and we have no oversight or any control over them. Now, why should the U.S. have the right to inspect Iran or to bring sanctions against Iran when we violated the NPT in every way, and they haven't violated it in any way? And I think that this really boils down to they don't have any stick to bludgeon Iran with or to blackmail or extort things from them, cooperation and submission, because Iran doesn't have any debt to the World Bank or to other international financial institutions. And what Iran did was they started enriching uranium for their nuclear power program, and Israel and the U.S. Started filing objections at the UN and accusing them of making nuclear weapons, and they had a nuclear weapon program or they were close to it. So what Iran did was they said, okay, we'll give our enriched uranium to Turkey, and Turkey will pass it on to Brazil, and Brazil can sell it on the market or whatever. Iran created a partnership with Turkey and Brazil, which was outside the control of the West, in other words, the U.S. So that made just enraged the United States and, of course, Israel, too. The Iran-Turkey pipeline is another very sore point. This is also aggravated tension between Iran and the Western countries, who are competitors really in the oil business, because Iran started pumping their oil through Turkey to ports in Turkey and to the European countries to market Iran's oil and gas, and the Western bankers and the World Bank and Wall Street and the City of London didn't get any cut on Iran's oil and gas. They couldn't they couldn't steal that money like we've done in Iraq. So that pipeline and that unaccountability, Iran's being outside of the sphere of influence or control of the West, is a flashpoint for nuclear issues with the U.S. and Israel and Britain. Now, you have to remember the U.S. and Israel are just subcontractors for Britain. It's really Britain who is behind all of this, and it goes back to the old relationship of British Petroleum. Starting in Iran, they got kicked out, and when I think the Shah nationalized Iranian oil, and once you cross those bankers, once you cross that financial establishment, they will never, ever, ever forgive you. And Haiti's a good example. It's the only slave revolution in world history that was successful. And they've been kept in poverty and attacked and attacked and attacked in every conceptual way that is imaginable for the last 200 years.
Well, you know, this hour has just flown by, and we have only about a minute and a half left in the program, and there's a great deal to cover. So I think that we're going to wind it up here, but one place to start up in our next program on this subject will be to intertwine a subject that we have covered, that is BP and the Gulf of Mexico disaster, and see how this is related. Is this related to Iran?
Mm-hmm.
And begin to intertwine those two issues.
That's very, very interesting. And what I'd like to say, could I quote Henry Kissinger?
Sure. We have just under a minute.
Okay. Henry Kissinger said, if you control the food, you control a nation. If you control the energy, you control a region. If you control the money, you control the world. And the U.S. and Britain are going for the whole ball of wax, control of the world. And it's not really the U.S. that is going to benefit, we're going to pay for it. But Israel and the U.S. are part of the British methodology of carrying out this goal.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Loren. And as I said, we're going to have to invite you back to pick it up on our next program on the relationship of British Petroleum, the BP and Gulf of Mexico disaster, and the secret war, the secret nuclear war against Iran. So we've been with independent scientist Loren Murray. This is the Monday Brown Bagger. I'm Alfred Weber. May you have a wonderful and miracle-filled day. Thank you.